have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakati.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, and he was the ninth divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was brought up in the house of Nubuwa, Prophethood, and Imamat, a house by which Allah had honored the Muslims all across the world. And so Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam grew up in the shade of that honored and noble house, while he received high ideals, morals, values, knowledge, and wisdom from his father, the eighth divinely appointed Imam, who shed rays of light from his great soul unto Imam al-Jawad. Imam al-Jawad's father, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, himself had undertaken the upbringing, the nurturing, the education of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. And so we find that Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam took Imam al-Jawad with him wherever he went and fed him with his own hands. A divinely appointed Imam, nurtured and educated by a divinely appointed Imam.
A IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your listeners. It's great to have you with us. You are listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the dialogues of the ninth divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. We have heard the various descriptions of the Almighty Allah. Of course, when we say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, we are saying in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. The one who is merciful to both his creatures in this world and the next. And of course, he is the all-merciful and all-encompassing mercy. The Almighty Allah is the most compassionate, the most kind, the most merciful. And of course, the most quick to forgive. These beautiful attributes of the Almighty Allah, which truly make his servants and his creatures in awe of the majesty of the Almighty Allah. We find in a conversation with Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, who was speaking with his companions about certain descriptions of the Almighty Allah, that His Eminence, the ninth divinely appointed Imam, said, "When someone commits a sin and they know that Allah sees them, and that Allah may punish them if Allah likes, or if Allah wishes, He will forgive them. Allah will forgive that individual even before they ask Allah for forgiveness." What a beautiful description of the Almighty Allah, His mercy, His most quick to forgive. But of course, here there are certain things that we must on our behalf do. One is, of course, that if, God forbid, we commit a sin, then we should know that the Almighty Allah has seen us. The Almighty Allah has witnessed this committing of sin and this committing of disobedience by us. And, of course, after realizing that the Almighty Allah has seen us and has witnessed us committing a certain sin, then we must realize that we are at the mercy of the Almighty Allah as to whether He will forgive us or He will punish us for committing that sin. Once we realize these things, the natural result is that we will hasten towards asking for forgiveness from the Almighty Allah. And it is this point that before we even ask for forgiveness from the Almighty Allah, that He forgives us that sin that we committed. A beautiful description that has been given to us about the mercy and the compassion and the kindness of the Almighty Allah. If we do commit a mistake, we must realize that we have been watched and it has been witnessed by the Almighty Allah, and that we are truly at His mercy, whether He wants to forgive us or punish us. And if we are to do this, the Almighty Allah will forgive us even before us asking for forgiveness. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
And now we invite you to listen to Shaykh Winay Keita about Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Imam al-Jawad salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi is an interesting case study for many, many different subjects. In the case of the ninth Imam, there was a lot of controversy surrounding his imamate. And as we know, in many occasions, the imamate is not a matter of public opinion or public choice. In fact, Imam Rida, in a very beautiful hadith in Ma'ani al-Akhbar and al-Kafi, It is narrated in a very long hadith where Imam Rida gives the attributes of the imams based on the Quran and so on and so forth. It's a very, very beautiful hadith where he continues to mention again and again and again that the qadr of the imama, the sha'n of the imama, the weight of the imama is such that it cannot be left to public opinion. It is not a democratic vote among the Hashemites who will get together and decide who they think is the best candidate to succeed, or the Quraysh, or or this tribe or that tribe. There is no such thing as this. The imam is designated by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, period. There is no such thing as ikhtiyar. In fact, Imam Rida goes on to call the people who think that this is a matter of public choice and preference are fools, and not only fools, they are ignorant fools, he uses the word. Juhal, he says. Again and again and again. Anyone who thinks the imamate is a matter of public preference might as well apply the same rules to the religion itself. Because if the perfection of religion lies in wilaya, then the religion might as well be up to the preferences of the people. So thus the imamate cannot be left to the preferences of the people.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi arrived in Damascus on Wednesday leading a high-ranking delegation. The president then headed to the presidential palace where he was received by his Syrian counterpart Bashar al-Assad with an official welcoming ceremony. The two officials held talks in which Assad underlined the importance and depth of relations with the Islamic Republic. He noted that both countries share visions based on respecting mutual interests and the two countries' sovereignty. Assad thanked Iran for its mediation efforts in Syria-Turkey peace talks and expressed support for Iran's right to peaceful nuclear energy. Raisi, for his part, congratulated Assad on Syria's victory in the war on his country, hailing resistance as an effective tool for free people of the world. He stressed relations between Syria and Iran were never affected by regional or international developments, reiterating his country's support for the people and government of Syria.
We discuss different topics as well as means of boosting our bilateral relations. We are determined to develop and expand our ties with regional states without a presence of foreigners, as they only cause instability. We should get rid of U.S. forces in our region. Securing Syria's sovereignty necessitates the withdrawal of U.S. troops.
The two presidents signed a long-term strategic comprehensive cooperation agreement. Ministers of both countries also signed a number of memorandums of understanding in the fields of oil, agriculture, rail and aerial transportation, free trade zones, earthquake reliefs, communications and information technologies.
Agreements today, as well as projects discussed, will push forward our relations through mechanisms that will increase the bulk of trade exchange and investments. This would reduce the impact of economic sanctions, especially at a time when world economic balance is shifting eastwards, and this would liberate world economies from Western hegemonies.
Assad also welcomed the restoration of diplomatic ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Officials are also set to discuss the establishment of a joint bank and insurance entity that would facilitate trade. The visit further consolidates the already historic and strong ties between Iran and Syria. It clearly launches a new phase of economic partnership following a successful military and political collaboration that set an example in the region in fighting terror and foiling U.S. and Western plots. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
It was his sixth hunger strike and the longest, which lasted for 87 consecutive days. Palestinian prisoner Sheikh Khadr Adnan stubbornly resisted until his last breath, asking for his release he always obtained after every hunger strike against his illegal administrative detention by the Israeli authorities. This time, however, his hunger strike ended with his martyrdom in a cold cell in the Israeli prison of Ramli at dawn on Tuesday. Here in his hometown, Arabi, near the occupied Jenin, his wife spoke to the crowd who gathered outside their home to consolidate the family and his nine children. They called for his revenge and also for all Palestinian prisoners languishing in Israeli jails.
I congratulate myself and my children for the martyrdom of Sheikh Khader. Now, after his death and all the sacrifices he made, we do not want a drop of his blood to be spilled. We will not wait for anyone to avenge my husband. His nine children will keep his cause alive. And to the Israeli occupation, I say, remember the faces of my children well. By God, we have raised them with pride and dignity.
A general strike has been announced across the occupied West Bank in mourning for Sheikh Khadr Adnan. Protests have been held in several areas, including Ramallah. Palestinian resistance groups have mourned what they described as the execution of the senior leader of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, Khadr Adnan. They say they hold the Israeli occupying regime fully responsible for Adnan's murder. Since 2004, Adnan had gone on six hunger strikes, drawing local and international attention. Not only did he become a spokesperson for the Islamic Jihad, but also a symbol for the cause of Palestinian prisoners.
The Israeli regime has sent a clear message to the whole world that we will continue killing Palestinians even after their imprisonment. Today, Sheikh Khadr Adnan has set a new level full of pride in the history of Palestinian prisoner movement. After his assassination, the Palestinian people are facing a new stage of struggle. Today, we all must unite and stand against the practices of the Israeli regime for the sake of our prisoners.
All Palestine is sad for the martyrdom of the hero prisoner Sheikh Khadr Adnan. It was not his first hunger strike. Every time he was courageously declaring a hunger strike to reject the illegal administrative detention that the occupation's regime uses to keep thousands of our people behind bars. Unfortunately, this time his strike came to an end with his martyrdom.
Meanwhile, several protests have been held in the occupied Ramallah in response to the Israeli murder of Sheikh Khadr Adnan. The demonstrations turned violent in a number of areas, namely the cities of Arram, Al-Khalil, and Ramallah, with clashes erupting between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian protesters. Israeli forces fired at the crowds, and a number of Palestinians were wounded. The Day of Rage will always be remembered as a day of honor and loyalty to Sheikh Khadr Adnan, who is considered by many here as a national hero. Every time Sheikh Khadr Adnan engaged in a hunger strike, he insisted that he will not end his action without achieving victory. His definition of victory was either getting released or being martyred. This time he achieved victory by martyrdom. Palestinians also believe he was an iconic figure who succeeded in bringing another defeat to the Israeli regime. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Against the backdrop of that all-familiar soundtrack and amid heavy police presence, pro-Palestinian protesters outside the Leicester branch of the notorious Israeli arms maker Elbit Systems. A short walk into the woods from the demo, members of the Palestine Action Group, donning the iconic Palestinian keffiyeh with one purpose in mind.
I'd like to see Elbit out of the UK. I'd like to see Elbit shut down once and for all in the whole world. But obviously, you know, where we are and what we can do is get Elvet out of the UK, and ultimately that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see Elvet systems completely gone from UK soil.
Beyond the steel fence and barbed wire, Elbit's UAV tactical systems manufactures drones on UK soil. Drones allegedly tested on the captive population of Gaza.
When I was there in Gaza for 2 years, I saw what those weapons do, and they are knowingly making them, selling them. In fact, they are even marketing them based on how much horror they have committed across Palestine and still ongoing.
Members of Palestine Action and other Palestinian supporters have come here today saying they're having to take direct action against Elbit systems because lobbying the British government through normal channels is futile. And they're calling on people around the world to join their campaign to put an end to Israel's international arms trade.
Elbit, Israel's largest weapons maker, used to host 10 sites across Britain. 18 months of protests and blockades by Palestine Action forced its site in Oldham, Greater Manchester, shut last year.
And it's time. It's time that Israel finally got brought to justice. We've seen enough horror, murder, oppression, occupation, ethnic cleansing. Enough. We've had enough.
The last time Palestine Action tried to close Elbit's Leicester site was 2 years ago. This time, they say, they won't leave until they have finished the job. Saeed Pariza, London.
It has become a well-trodden political path, Press TV being attacked in the British Parliament. This time the mouthpiece was the vice chair of the Conservatives' Friends of Israel.
A shocking report into the online activities of Press TV, particularly their use of a video series called Palestine Declassified, which focuses its hatred on British Jews. Whilst Press TV may be banned from our airways, this foreign state hate operation is continuing online. Can we have a debate at some point on what more we can do to ensure that social media platforms tackle this outrageous content?
In the decade and a half since it was established, Press TV has found itself front and center of Western media attacks. But despite the pressure, the channel continues to advocate for the voiceless, chief amongst them, the Palestinians. The show at the heart of the latest onslaught is Palestine Declassified. Its host, former Labour MP Chris Williamson, gave his take on why the show was such a bone of contention for the pro-Israel lobby.
What we've seen here is a shameless attempt by the Israel lobby in the House of Parliament to whitewash Israel's criminality and lawlessness. And of course, they're very concerned about the fact that Palestine Declassified is shining a light into the murky corners of Israel's activities, and indeed on the lobby that seeks to avoid any criticism of their suppression of the Palestinian people. It's Palestine Declassified is, you know, very effective. It scrupulously researches all of the content that we put out. And obviously, you know, they're embarrassed by the truth that we are bringing to a wider public. And of course, you know, the traction that Palestine Declassified is now picking up, it's been suggested, reaching well over 11 million people now. So they're doing their damnedest now, it seems to me, to try and close down our success.
Chris has written a stern letter rebuking some of the smears parroted by Andrew Percy.
There's no truth whatsoever to the allegations that you made. I mean, it suggested that, you know, we sort of are a vehicle for hatred towards British Jews. I mean, the programme is doesn't sort of promote hate in any respect, or it suggested anyway that he should consider apologising for maligning me and for impugning the reputation of Palestine Declassified and Press TV.
As Palestinians continue to live under an oppressive regime, Press TV's fight to advocate for justice will see it targeted as part of Israel's campaign to close down anyone who stands up for the Palestinian cause, a move branded media terrorism. Amina Taylor, London.
The members of the Pakistani parliament are insisting the coalition government to eliminate obstacles in starting the oil trade with neighboring Iran to overcome the country's energy deficiency. MPs' voices were heard during the recent meetings of the parliamentary committees, in which lawmakers stressed upon the government officials to robust diplomacy for aggressively pursuing options to secure waivers on the oil trade with Iran.
We get 1 million liters of diesel from Iran every day. It's called so-called smuggling, and it's, I think, 50 rupees per liter as compared to here. We should open this up. The region has to open up.
The lawmakers recommended that all-out efforts should be made to secure waivers from sanctions on oil trade with Iran.
I've been saying to the government also that we should open up these borders because, like, for the first time, Iran-Afghanistan trade is more than Pakistan-Afghanistan trade. And I think if they can have it, and it's benefiting both countries, so this trade would be very good for us also.
According to the data provided by Pakistan's Commerce Ministry to the Parliament, Pakistan's trade with Iran has crossed over $2 billion, covering food, medicines, cotton, and pharmaceutical products.
This is a huge project. We are engaged in talks with Pakistani authorities over this issue, and both countries will manage to come up with a positive solution very soon.
Like the rest of the world, Pakistan is no exception to the global energy crisis, which is worsening with each passing day. Experts say Islamabad plans to buy oil and gas from Iran, but wants to do in such a way that it escapes sanctions from the US and other Western countries.
Although the bilateral trade between Iran and Pakistan has now reached over $2 billion, however, both sides believe that more efforts should be made to strengthen the trade relations further and to support the business community of the two countries. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Turkish Defense Minister Hulusi Akar said there are positive signs that Turkey and Syria could be close to reaching an agreement that would facilitate the return of 3.6 million Syrian refugees to home. Akar talked about the meeting that took place in Moscow between him and Syrian Defense Minister Ali Mahmoud Abbas with the participation of Iranian and Russian counterparts. The Turkish minister said things will not be solved in one meeting after 11 years of strained relations. However, he says both sides are aware that through dialogue they can find common ground.
We got together with the Syrian defense minister for the first time in 11 years. It was an important meeting. Dialogue is the key. Both sides acknowledge this. It is, of course, not possible to resolve everything at once. Naturally, the parties may have maximalist demands, but we are trying to turn those demands into reasonable ones.
Damascus says its main demand is for Turkish troops to leave the Syrian territory, with officials repeating in every meeting that the road to normalization can only be paved by the withdrawal of thousands of Turkish troops from the Arab country. This point was again raised in last week's meeting and stressed by the Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad. He said it is impossible to talk about normalization as the Turkish army continues to occupy Syria's northern areas. But Turkey says its presence in Syria is aimed at fighting terrorism and creating a safe environment for the Syrian people, as well as protecting shared borders, which is Turkey's main concern. Turkey is also worried from a new round of clashes, which could lead to a new wave of refugees.
Both sides have their demands. The Turkish side wants security guarantees. They don't want to see any type of autonomous structure in the northeast of Syria that is led by the YPG group. This is a major security concern for Turkey. And Turkey also has almost 4 million Syrian refugees that it would like to slowly see repatriated in the future. We're still far apart on the demands from both sides for normalization. But this doesn't mean that both sides can't come together on a transactional basis to try to further issues that are of mutual interest.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has hoped that he can reach an agreement with Syria before the upcoming presidential and parliamentary election. Sending refugees back is one of the Turkish people's main concerns, and opposition parties are playing the card of Syrian refugees against Erdogan in their campaigns. A normalization of relations between Ankara and Damascus will definitely ease the pressure on Turkey, whether regarding the refugee crisis or armed groups operating in Syria that Turkey sees as terrorists. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Iran has successfully tested a homegrown plane engine and its control system. The engine was built by experts of Mapna Industrial Group using the reverse engineering method. The testing process was observed by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, who was visiting the company on the occasion of the International Workers' Day. Raisi visited an exhibition on Mapna Group's technological achievements in the fields of thermal and renewable energy power plants, oil and gas, rail transportation, air engines, electric cars, and so forth. During his visit, the Iranian president praised the company, saying he is proud of the efforts made by skilled workers and experts of Mapna.
We must be proud of this level of work, endeavor, creativity, innovation, skill, knowledge, and technology. Truly, this company is one of the industrial groups that have made us proud. It has also made our country more powerful. They have accomplished a lot, and they have lots of important projects that will be completed in the future.
Raisi described the achievements as significant, saying the company's productions are quality enough to be sold on regional and global markets. In 2022, the Mapna Group won an award for being one of the top three Iranian exporters of the year. In July, the company's technology and engineering exports topped 2.5 billion euros.
The major achievements of the Mapna Industrial Group have once again proved that sanctions cannot hinder Iran's development. Iranians have time and again shown that where there is a will, there is a way. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Paris was on fire for May Day, International Workers' Day, once again. Hundreds were arrested, hundreds were hurt, and tear gas was a constant for hours. The demonstration route was littered with broken glass and fires after cops repeatedly intervened in the march. Protesters targeted banks, insurance vendors, real estate agencies, and sexist advertising, and then the end of the march turned into a multi-hour battle royale.
Tear gas is sadly typical of how our government deals with political demonstrations. French democracy has been tarnished worldwide and appears ridiculous, as it's clearly not based on representative democracy.
Over 2 million people marched nationwide as unions declared May Day the 13th major day of protest this year against a 2-year hike to the pension age, which was rammed into law by executive decree last month. The undemocratic proclamation of the law, combined with the shocking police brutality, had many French people questioning their country's democratic bona fides.
France allows for demonstrations, but the problem is that police don't allow it. We saw that with the yellow vests, and we have seen it again from the very start of the pension protests this year.
Macron has to stop showing such contempt for the people. As a yellow vest, I promise that we will never stop fighting for a real democracy. We want referendums and public participation, while Macron has fear for the people.
International Workers' Day began in Chicago in 1886 with the fight for an 8-hour workday. It wouldn't be implemented in the West until after their political and financial elites forced World War I, which was largely an effort to maintain monarchical privileges and to forestall socialist-inspired reforms. Protesters insist they can apply enough pressure on the president to get the unpopular law revoked, something protests also forced in 2006. Press TV's cameraman was hit by a tear gas grenade fired by police seconds before the start of a live interview from the demonstration. It appears like a clear case of police targeting media, as tear gas is normally shot high into the air. The cameraman was not badly hurt, as the projectile only exploded after it ricocheted off his leg. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the Home Office plans to house asylum seekers in 10 unused cruise ships, ferries and barges in ports around the country. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The Home Office is planning to use 10 redundant cruise ships, ferries and barges to house asylum seekers in ports around the country, with Liverpool expected to be next in line as ministers struggle to get to grips with the asylum backlog. Officials have been told to look at all options to find housing for people caught up in processing delays, including former military camps and prisons. With the total backlog more than 1,500 higher than in December, when Prime Minister Rishi Sunak pledged to clear it within a year. Home Office insiders have conceded that they may have to find more hotels to house people, despite pressure from Conservative backbench MPs after failing to locate 10,000 spaces in military camps, disused prisons and large vessels as hoped. The Guardian has been told that one leading maritime company is even conducting a feasibility study into housing migrants on redundant oil rigs, an idea that ministers rejected back in 2020 as a no-go because of enormous logistical and safety difficulties, and the Home Office is unlikely to adopt. The revelation that the government wants as many as 10 vessels at a cost of millions of pounds to the taxpayer comes after ministers confirmed plans to house about 400 people in a giant barge in Dorset, as they try to allay concerns from backbench Conservative MPs over the use of hotels in their constituencies. The barge, Bibby Stockholm, will be berthed in Portland Port from early June. The first group of migrants expected to be single men nearing the end of their asylum processing claims are expected to board the barge later that month, with more people arriving over the summer. Whitehall sources said that Suella Braverman, the Home Secretary, was also close to confirming a deal for a 1,800-capacity former cruise ship to house migrants that would be berthed in the Mersey, although no contract has yet been signed. Peel Ports, which owns and operates port infrastructure in the Birkenhead area, has said it would only go ahead with the plans if there was full engagement with the local council. Local politicians, however, have condemned the proposal, pointing to a lack of infrastructure and describing the plans as a floating prison. Ministers are reported to be plotting to force Prime Minister Sunak's illegal migration bill into law if it is blocked or watered down by the House of Lords this summer, with plans to use the Parliament Act to overrule peers to force the legislation onto the statute book. Nevertheless, the rarely used device is unlikely to succeed before the next general election, as the government must wait 12 months after a law is rejected by the House of Lords. Instead, ministers who are keen to sound tough on small boat crossings before this week's local elections are expected to blame peers for their failure to deliver. The search for suitable vessels to house asylum seekers and the logistics of where to berth them are believed to have hindered the Home Office's attempts to clear the asylum backlog, with hundreds of migrants still arriving across the channel every week. Home Office sources said they did not have a target for the number of vessels that they planned to use. Industry insiders said there was a shortage of barges available on market, with many in use for offshore construction projects, and some other governments also said to be interested in acquiring them to house migrants. Ministers had initially planned to use disused cruise ships and ferries, as they were able to accommodate more people. The Guardian has reported that possible vessels included a former cruise ship from Indonesia. Few ports in the United Kingdom are big enough to accommodate them. The Guardian has been told that officials have been asked to find another 10,000 places not in hotels for the end of this year, but so far just 5,400 places are expected to be ready to receive migrants by the end of this year. They include accommodation at the former military bases at Wethersfield and Scampton, which would hold 3,700 people, and reopening of immigration detention centres in Haslar in Hampshire and Campsfield near Oxford, which would hold 1,000. A further 1,200 people could be accommodated at North Eye, a former prison in East Sussex, and at barracks in Catterick, in Rishi Sunak's North Yorkshire constituency, while 400 people would be placed on the barge in Portland, Dorset. One government source said the use of giant barges or refurbished ferries and cruise ships to house refugees could have a deterrent effect on people arriving in small boats across the channel, although critics suggest it would amount to arbitrary detention. The website youractive.com has also covered this story and tells us more. The Home Office plans to house asylum seekers in 10 unused cruise ships, ferries and barges in ports around the country. Officials have been told to look at all options to find housing for asylum seekers dealing with processing delays. This includes former military camps and even prisons. In December, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said the government expected to abolish the backlog of initial asylum decisions by the end of next year. This means the Home Office would need to make nearly 25,000 decisions a quarter to meet this promise. The Home Office is also launching a 3-day hackathon in May to search for quicker ways to reduce the asylum backlog. The Home Office also plans to use artificial intelligence to process the 138,052 undecided asylum cases. The United Kingdom has also been working on an illegal migration bill, which would enable the detention of unlawful arrivals without bail or judicial review within the first 28 days of detention until they can be removed. It includes provisions to prevent asylum seekers from claiming to be a victim of modern-day slavery to avoid or delay their removal. On 27th of March this year, in a letter addressed to both chambers of Britain's Parliament, the Council of Europe's Commissioner for Human Rights, Dunja Mijatovic, urged lawmakers to vote against the bill. The regional newspaper, the Liverpool Echo, has also covered this story. The government is considering housing as many as 1,800 asylum seekers on a vessel moored off the Wirral, the Liverpool Echo understands. Local politicians and charities have raised concerns about the plans, which would form part of the government's highly controversial new policy for placing newly arrived migrants on barges, cruise ships, disused ferries and military bases, and other vessels that have been described by some as floating prisons. The Liverpool Echo understands that any such boat could be moored on water in Birkenhead, close to Wirral Waters, which is a £4.5 billion waterfront development currently being built by the Peel Group. Peel Ports owns and operates the waters and port infrastructure in the Birkenhead area and says it will only go ahead with the plans with full engagement with the local authority. The government has not directly confirmed the Wirral plan, but says it is looking at moving asylum seekers out of hotels and onto barges and ferries in a bid to cut down on costs. Charities say that if applications for asylum were being properly processed, then no such measures would be required. Speaking about the potential Wirral plans, Wallasey MP Angela Eagle said, "I think this policy is an admission of failure. If the government was doing its day job properly and processing asylum applications properly, then we would not be in this position." Wirral Waters is a huge regeneration project. It doesn't have transport links to local services. So these people will be sort of on what effectively resembles a floating prison without any links to those services. There has been no advance consultation with local leaders. The way they are handling this just reeks of incompetence. Hotels in the Wallasey and Hoy Lake area of Wirral are currently being used to house asylum seekers. It is not clear if the plan would be to move those currently based in those hotels onto a vessel in the water off the peninsula. Claire Mosley is the founder of the National Care for Calais charity, who also lives in Wirral. Claire Mosley says, "It has been encouraging and heartwarming to see the response of the local community to asylum seekers in Wallasey and Hoy Lake. We know the Wirral is a tolerant and welcoming place. However, placing a high number of people in confined housing on our shores will place a strain on the local community and on local services. This type of accommodation does not give asylum seekers access to the community's support that they really need."
Seven barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. Islam as a religion, as a way of life, obviously caters for every single aspect, every single function, every single facet of our lives. Therefore, we can see that those who claim that Islam has nothing to do with politics or politics has nothing to do with Islam are severely mistaken. And it is not something that is, you know, specific to a specific group of Muslims. No, Muslims in general, if they open their eyes to the verses of the magnificent and the glorious Quran, we will see many verses that deal with, you know, establishing an upright system by which all people can live by. And obviously, after the Islamic Revolution, and obviously maybe at times just before it, there were many Muslim thinkers, one who we will mention, inshallah, in our next segment, who strive to express and to propound this point that Islam, as a religion, as the final religion, as a religion of truth, has the, you know, principles within it by which a human society, by which human governance, by which people themselves, society, can be governed in a way that reaches and takes everybody towards felicity. So inshallah, we will mention the book or one of the books that are based on this in our next segment, inshallah. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. As we mentioned in our previous segment, the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners today is one that is based on Islam and obviously the function that Islam has and the principles that can be found within Islamic teachings in the establishment or an Islamic government or an Islamic place of society. So the book that we would like to introduce for our dear listeners today is titled In Pursuit of the Power of Islam. This book is a compilation of the major writings of Brother Kalim Siddiqui, rahmatullah alayhi, who passed away. And this book was compiled and edited by Dr. Zafar Bangash. This book was published in Canada, in Toronto, and it was published by the Open Press Publications. So a little bit about Dr. Siddiqui. And Dr. Siddiqui grew up in Pakistan, obviously, and then he passed away in the United Kingdom. So Dr. Kalim Siddiqui was a very profound thinker, and obviously his thought, like many other Muslim intellectuals that have come from the subcontinent, affected many thinkers in the English-speaking Western world. And this book that we have, or this book that I've introduced, obviously stresses on the global Islamic movement, which he kind of emphasized. And the writings that are collected in here, that were collected by Zafar Bangash, who was a very close associate with Dr. Kalim Siddiqui, in which he compiles 25 major, rather in this particular collection of works, the major works of Dr. Kalim Siddiqui that he produced over the last 25 years are compiled by his close associate, Dr. Zafar Bangash. So for example, some of the things that we can find in this book, for example, Political Thought and Behavior of Muslims Under Colonization. And this is one of the important things for us to understand, that majority of the Muslims, you know, after World War II and the British kind of colonization or the European colonization of the Muslim lands, what is a Muslim's duty? What should a Muslim do? Another one, for example, nation states as obstacles to the total transformation of the Ummah. You know, a history of how the Islamic lands were cut into pieces, given to certain families. For example, we have it right now that the Gulf states and certain families who rule these states, how they were cut, how the lines were drawn. And you can see the lines are very nice and straight. And there are jokes that are mentioned about those crooked lines. And many other different writings, which in total are 13. And one of the major things that impacted the thought of Dr. Kalim Siddiqui was the Islamic Revolution of Iran, which on many places in this book he mentions, and the movement of that great saint of our time, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. So inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a portion of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past. But where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. The book that we introduced to our dear listeners is titled In Pursuit of the Power of Islam, a collection of the major writings of Dr. Kalim Siddiqui that has been compiled and edited by Dr. Zafar Bangash, and published by the Open Press of Toronto or in Toronto, Canada. So the part of the book that we would like to read is the sixth collection or the sixth writing article that has been kind of placed in this book. It is titled The Islamic Revolution, Achievements, Obstacles and Goals. Obviously, the Islamic Revolution meant here is the Islamic Revolution that occurred in Iran. Recently, I had the good fortune of spending 2 weeks in Iran. I was one of the 300 guests from all parts of the Ummah who were invited to Iran to join the celebrations of the start of the year 1400. So this is now, so about 1980, of the Hijri calendar, and of the first anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. In the party, there was also a journalist from Poland. I asked him what he thought of the Islamic Revolution, and he shot back that it is not a class revolution. This was his complaint about the Islamic Revolution. It was therefore necessary for us to try to set the Islamic Revolution apart from all other revolutions. We have to understand exactly what is involved in an Islamic Revolution. So, for most of this afternoon, I shall be trying to define an Islamic Revolution. I shall also attempt to identify and describe the elements that have gone to make the Islamic Revolution. First, we must disabuse our minds of the common usage of the word revolution. It is used in terms of a palace revolution, a coup d'etat, a consumer revolution, a transistor revolution, a technical revolution, a revolution of rising expectations, and so on. It is a loosely used term. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to truly unite the hearts of the ummah, to try and follow the path of thinkers, intellectuals, and those who truly thought and whose heart beat for the ummah of Islam, the ummah of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. May the soul of Dr. Kalim Siddiqui rest in peace, inshallah. Maybe have the benefit of the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in his grave, inshallah. Until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.